which is what college radio is good for. That's a reason. Yeah, I did a little bit. I mean, cassettes are difficult to play on the radio.
Yes.
Especially if you just want to play one part of it. They are. But every once in a while, I'd put on a long.
Hello, my name is Holly Hedgepeth, and I'm with the Cancer Services Program of Columbia and Greene County, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA.
Common Ground is a private, not-for-profit organization offering dispute resolution services to the people in Columbia and Greene counties. Common Ground provides trained mediators who work to resolve the differences between two or more participants on issues including family, housing, business, workplace, school and neighborhood disputes. The mediation process is informal, private, confidential, and voluntary. For more information, please contact Common Ground at 518-943-0523 or on our website www.commongroundinc.org.
Tickets are now available at wavefarm.org/drive-in for an unforgettable drive-in event with Negative Land and Sue C., Matt Mose, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt opening. Turn out for Negative Land's legendary sound collage and real-time cinema with Sue C., along with Matt Mose's renowned electronic music and sampling culture. This and so much more at the Greenville Drive-In, Friday, May 31st. All to support Wave Farm and WGXE. Tickets are going fast. Get yours now. Drive-In is all one word at wavefarm.org/drive-in.
WGXE underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXE is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Peter McPartland of Hudson, New York. WGXE's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXE as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXE sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxe.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
This is deprogramming from the Universal Media Network.
Breaking ranks with Biden on Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Israel's assault on Gaza has provoked protests around the globe, including in the United States. While attention lately has focused on college campuses, another protest movement has emerged. Dissenters within the U.S. government who offer a behind-the-scenes critique of U.S. policies that are devastating Gaza. Despite this wave of informed dissent, President Joe Biden, while calling for a ceasefire, continues to provide arms and diplomatic cover to Israel.
There's widespread sentiment within all levels of the administration and all agencies that the president's continued support for Israel's assault on Gaza is disastrous.
Lily Greenberg Call said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, she was a special assistant to the chief of staff at the Interior Department and a Biden political appointee, but resigned her position on May 15th, citing in her four-page resignation letter, quote, President Biden's disastrous continued support for Israel's genocide in Gaza, unquote.
It's disastrous for American foreign policy, for sentiment towards Americans abroad. It's disastrous here at home. And it's very devastating that the leadership of the administration is not only not listening to their colleagues, but to the majority of the American people who want a ceasefire, who are horrified by what's happening in Gaza.
Greenberg Kaul is the latest Biden administration official to resign over Gaza, and also the first Jewish appointee to do so. Her decision to leave was deeply influenced by her Judaism. She resigned on May 15th, the day Palestinians commemorate the Nakba, when 76 years ago, close to 1 million Palestinians were driven from their homes and tens of thousands were massacred as Jewish militias engaged in ethnic cleansing during the creation of the State of Israel. Greenberg Kaul wrote in her resignation letter, quote, "Nakba and Shoah, the Hebrew word for Holocaust, mean the same thing, catastrophe. I reject the premise that one people's salvation must come at another's destruction. I'm committed to creating the world where this does not happen, and this cannot be done from within the Biden administration," she wrote.
I was raised with a fairy tale about the Nakba. The Nakba was something that I, you know, was not really told about, and if anything, it was minimized and trivialized. Was raised with this idea that Israel was a land without a people for a people without a land. And, you know, so if there's no Palestinian society, if there's nothing to be destroyed, then there's nothing to mourn. So I felt as a Jewish person that it was particularly important for me to acknowledge the significance of the Nakba and the Nakba that has never really ended, that continues to this day.
Lily Greenberg Kaul was not always critical of Israel. In 2019, as a college student at UC Berkeley, she was president of Bears for Israel, affiliated with AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee.
There was no daylight between being Jewish and support for the State of Israel in the community I was raised in.
Lily Greenberg Kaul said. She continued explaining her political transformation.
As I got a little older, over the past 8 years or so, there two things started to happen at once, or at the same time. So the first was that my world started to expand. I was able to get to know Palestinians, Palestinian Americans. I worked with some Syrian Palestinian refugees in Greece. I saw for myself some of the injustices that Palestinians face in Israel-Palestine, the checkpoints, you know, the system of apartheid. And started to, you know, those, they didn't feel in alignment with my values, right? And with the kind of country that, you know, the kind of world that I want to live in. So that was happening. I also studied Arabic and just, you know, had all this exposure to Palestinian culture and life. And at the same time, the coalition of people that I was, you know, advocating for Israel with through AIPAC started to move to the right. As Trump came to power, as the Israeli government shifted to the right, and I started to see these people who I had spent years doing pro-Israel advocacy with, in particular, you know, the evangelical Christians, support Trump and support right-wing fascists here in the United States, and people who were, you know, aligning themselves with white supremacists and anti-Semites. Pikuach nefesh in Judaism, which means saving a life, and it supersedes any other commandment. You are allowed to break any commandment if it means saving a life. We also say to save a life is to save the whole world. There's this idea of B'Tselem Elohim, that every person is made in the image of God. You know, and so those values, in addition to the fact that Judaism is really steeped in a justice-oriented ethos, that we fight against authority. You know, Jews have been the victims of injustice, of legal injustice, of violence, of persecution, of displacement throughout our history, right? So I feel that I am really living in my Jewishness, in the essence of what I was raised with, by standing up for Palestinians and by demanding their freedom.
Lily Greenberg Kaul joins others who have resigned, like former State Department officials Josh Paul, who oversaw weapons transfers to other nations, including Israel, Chala Rerat, the first diplomat to resign over Gaza, who served as the key Arabic language spokesperson for state, and Anel Schielein, who worked on human rights issues in the Middle East, and who, after resigning, attended a federal worker Feds United for Peace rally in front of the White House. Schielein told Democracy Now!
When I started to tell colleagues that I was planning to resign over Gaza, so many people's response was, please speak out, please speak for us.
President Biden and his inner circle are increasingly isolated in their unflinching support for Israel's crimes in Gaza. Unlike Palestinians in Gaza, though, Biden has a way out. Permanent ceasefire now. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Jeff Economy, host of Snack Point Charlie, heard the first and third Wednesday of every month from 10 to midnight here on WGXC. I'm here today to talk with Dr. Drew Daniel and Martin Schmidt of Matmos, who will be performing as part of WGXC's drive-in extravaganza on May 31st. That's Negative Land plus Sue C., Matmos, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt, live at the Greenville Drive-In, May 31st. Tickets are available at wavefarm.org/drive-in. Well, speaking of starting, I'm not sure where to start this, but so I guess I'll start with the most recent record that I've heard. I'm not sure if there's anything after this that somehow come out, but Return to Archive.
You are correct.
All right.
It's the most recent record of Matmos's to come out that you can choose or choose not to listen to or purchase.
And you can choose or choose not to hear us play some of it live very soon.
very interesting. I have not had any idea what your specific plans are for the show, and I wasn't sure if you were going to keep that a secret, if you wanted to surprise us, or what your agenda was.
We will play some of it. I was just creating a video for it last night to go on the giant drive-in movie screen.
Very nice. It's a strange album. Return to Archive sits oddly, I think, in the Matmos canon, if I can say something so pompous, because mostly we tend to pick a concept that drives sampling choices, but it's often about objects. It's not really about sampling recordings made by others. You know, at the very beginning of Matmos, we had a lot of pieces that had tiny acts of theft, but they were usually concealed. They were sort of Easter eggs for a listener to dig in and go, oh my God, that's a little piece of David Bowie, or that's a little piece of Ligeti. But mostly we weren't about that. It wasn't really a Plunderphonic project. But in this case, we were sort of licensed to ill. You know, the Smithsonian Folkways was celebrating its 75th anniversary, and they asked us if we would be interested in making a record out of their back catalog. And we were really excited about it because we'd always loved Folkways records. I mean, there's so many really crazy records that they put out. But early on, we made a framing decision of, like, we're not going to remix other people's music. We're not going to, you know, take a loop of a blues song and, like, do a, you know, Moby to it. You know, that, like, that's not the approach that interested us. We wanted specifically the non-musical components and to make music out of things that are not already music was the foundation, I guess, for Return to Archive. It was really fun to do. It was also, like, there was sort of a gun to our head because it had to come out the 75th anniversary year. So we weren't able to just dawdle the way that sometimes
we do.
Yeah. We had to be really kind of lean and mean. And I think in a way that helped us get over the problem of too much, you know, that the archive of the back catalog is just like hundreds of hours of stuff. And like, you could spend your life, you could spend 10 years making that record if you wanted, but we had like, okay, do this in about 6 months. And for us, that was a cool challenge.
Yep. We made a whole song out of just a few seconds of what I'm going to guess is a very angry hornet in a ball jar, in a glass jar that has a microphone shoved in one end of it. And the hornet or
wasp.
It's a wasp. That's right. And the wasp comes closer and further away from the microphone. It's not a very long recording, but man, we cranked out a mean little song out of it.
Yeah, it was fun to make because it was about, you know, how far can you take something very particular that in terms of fidelity and audio is also really blown out and distorted and quite harsh. You know, it wasn't a kind of forensic, perfect capture. The person that made the recording, Albro T. Gall, was not a sound recordist. He was principally a photographer and entomologist, but he got interested in documenting insect sounds. And so he built a lot of custom electronics, especially custom preamps to amplify massively these intensely quiet sounds. And, you know, the result is really very kind of cruel mid-range. Like, there's no low end. There's not a lot in the highs either. It's just like this really nasty but thrilling document of a tiny life, you know, that moves so much faster than we do.
Okay, wait. We've been talking nonstop from the
I'm sorry. This is what it's like to interview us. We just like blah, blah. We're like running faucets. You need to make like a chopping gesture with at your neck. Shut the hell up, guys.
I have, you know, sort of a non-interventionist approach to interviews. Oh, if people want to go, hours. I'm going to let them go. But I am curious what you, you know, what you think Moses Ash would make of this. You know, would this have ever been on his radar in any conceivable universe?
You know, judging by the output of the Folkways record company, I'm going to say that Moses would be like, great, put it out. All right, what's next?
Yeah, they're, you know, sort of on to the next
one. He seemed to have a very procedural sort of, that's great. Is the art finished? All right, put it out.
Well, it's weird because, I mean, I think there's both quantity and quality with Folkways. It's just that...
I think there are some serious quality issues with some
Well, you mean in terms of fidelity, but not in terms of the human interest of the document.
Yeah, no, from before we started working on this, I've seen the cover of The Sounds of the American Office. I was like, I cannot wait to hear what the recordings are like. And the fact is that the recordings of The Sounds of the American Office are by any measure terrible, terrible recordings. They hum, they hiss, they have terrible signal to noise ratio. They're murky. I was so disappointed.
But it's great
we finally heard The Sounds of the American Office. But that's the gold of conceptual artwork, is that the Sounds of the American Office live in my mind more strongly than the actual thing. You know, I mean, you can just describe it, and the gold is there.
Well, it also seems to me that part of the agenda of that is to draw attention to the things that you wouldn't notice, that are so ubiquitous that you're not paying attention to them, and then you have them separated and recorded and play back, and you go, oh, that's in my environment all day, and I never think about it.
Yeah, there's such a vitality in the poetics of how the titles of tracks like frame extremely banal actions. You know, there's literally a track that's signing checks. It's like the sound of someone signing checks. You know, like, what could be more quintessentially American than that, you know?
That reminds me of, I once was listening to a very old episode of Dragnet, the radio show, long before the TV show. And I was kind of astounded to hear that it wasn't even like going on interviews and talking to perps, etc. It was just the sounds of filing and the sounds of office work. And, oh, Janet, can you get me a form, blah, blah, blah. And it was almost like this weird structuralist exercise because it was so different than what you would ever expect or even tolerate from a contemporary police show.
Wow. Yeah, that's why we end the first song with a woman's voice saying, good morning, electronics. You know, that there's this sort of social world of, you know, very stereotypical, like, male bosses who dictate to female secretaries and you know, capturing that socially, you know, we hear it with different ears now. It's the same sound, but it the connotations have changed. And that's, you know, that was what was fun about getting the license to work with this material. I mean, it's funny, too, to be heading towards a double bill with Negative Land, because I think their sort of plunderphonic, you know, manipulations of voices of authority is a big part of what makes them so funny. And we don't tend to make art that's like that. But because in the case of the Folkways back catalog, there's all these science and education records where a kind of, you know, white guy with a plummy voice tells you how sound works. You know, there's all these kind of audio authority figures, and it's so fun to get to, like, push off from them. So in some ways...
We were definitely thinking about Negative Land quite a bit when we were making this record, and perhaps consciously avoiding what Negative Land would do with them. No, but they're already doing it. They don't need to be
Too negative.
Two Negative Lands.
Well, what do you think you could bring to that space that that would maybe be adjacent or be sort of a Venn diagram with Negative Land that they don't already do? I mean, I love those things you do on the recent record with you know, Aaron Dillaway and Victoria Shen, and I'm curious where you would see that intersecting.
Yeah, I think the joy of tilting worlds against each other to make them seem ridiculous is shared by Negative Land and Matmus. I think that our interest in exploring rhythm and putting rhythm up front is really kind of different. I feel like there's often a sort of sideways, wonky funkiness to Negative Land's musical elements. And it's interesting that they've made that Speech Free album, because they're finally like, hey, what is Negative Land if we got rid of all the zippy sayings and ridiculous phrases and just heard the music as music. I think Matmus is maybe more psychedelic in the sense that we can get kind of lost in the details of a single set of sounds and just dig into them for a longer amount of time. So I think maybe the metabolisms are different. That's what I'd say. I don't know.
Everything. Where do we share?
We share humor. You know, I think we're not like self-serious people. You know, I think you can have concepts that drive what you do without losing sight of like the sort of basic ridiculousness of life. You know, I think that would be a false choice between humor and
yeah, the ability to look at things that are possibly, you know, deadly serious and still retain a sense of humor, maybe is where the Venn diagram intersects.
Right? I think they're more
that language yeah. work.
I mean, they're more secretly dystopian than we are.
Is yeah, I mean, they're much gloomier in the long run, but that's Wobbly's
yeah.
new influence. He is such a black cloud of
fear
yeah.
and doom. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to see doom everywhere, let's be honest, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it becomes a narcissism of small differences if we get into like, how are the sharks different from the jets?
Well, it seems like at this moment in history, how can you avoid the doom? Whether you're going directly into it and staring into the void and screaming back, or whether you're just laughing at it. I mean, there has to be a response somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, our systems are failing, and our systems exist to perpetuate themselves and to generate profit at the expense of literal, like, you know, ecological survival. So it is a high stakes moment. I think the sort of relentless falsehoods that surround us, you know, cry out for puncture. And like, my only hope, I guess, for art is that formally it embodies that experience of puncture, or it can. I don't know. I mean, some people want to make spa ambient and like they just want to chill and they want to like.
That is what out. It does. What does seem like that's what the kids want to do. It's just like, can we just crawl into a coffin that's really soft?
I think that's understandable too. Like a sort of longing for an alternative to a world of productivity, you know, might mean like maybe there's a coming wave of like softness or hyper localness or I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I'm 52, so I've lived through some boom bust style cycles and hype cycles. And I think that's an amazing thing about the present is that the kids are changing the past. You know, when you talk to them about what music they like from the 70s and 80s, they bring up all this really obscure stuff that to them is quintessentially expressive of a moment that you lived through. And you're like, we never listened to that, but that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that, you know. So I do have some hopes, you know, in the midst of how bad things are, that people's curiosity can become, you know, a way to shift what's possible and to dislodge the hold of the familiar. I mean, I say that in the middle of a week when Apple Music rolled out this 100 best albums of all time list that is, you know, so cynical and so racist and so, you know, so like presentist too. I don't know. So yeah, I'm not sure. There's a lot of reasons to be angry.
Angry or disappointed or just irritated. Yeah, I've noticed, I don't have kids myself, but I have friends that have younger children, teenagers, you know, maybe young adults, and their approach and what they respond to in music is different in a way that's often very surprising to me. Like, I'm older than you, I'm 59, and I grew up when having the loudest and the most aggressive music was at a premium. You know, I was in that scene with Steve Albini, and mm-hmm. And that sort of ethos resonates with me. But these kids, I don't mean that like these kids, but talking to them, they want things that aren't so aggressive, that aren't so pointed and sharp oftentimes. And it seems like there's a direct inverse correlation between what's happening in the world and where they're going for their comfort food.
Yeah. Yeah. Generational styles are going to change. And I think a sense of like softness as resistance to a world that, because it's all about grabbing attention as quickly as possible.
Well, I mean, you know, this is the problem with my making a statement about, like, this is what the kids... And the fact is that the world, in terms of music, the world is, like, shattered into a billion different pieces in a way that you and I'm also 59, in a way that we could never have even conceived of. You know, like, there were these, like, giant, in at least in my teenage consciousness, there were these giant continents of kinds of music, and there were details among them, but, you know, there was basically, like, rock, disco, country, you know, those, and, you know, there were, like, five, and it didn't really matter beyond that. And now, I mean, I have to celebrate the sort of like nuance with which the computer has, you know, the internet has shattered people's interest into all these like tiny facets of knowledge.
People who like Japanese city pop of the 80s, you know,
right.
Who only like Ukrainian, you know, black metal, or who only like the forms of music coming out of Brazil right now that I don't even know the names for, that just sound so completely strange. Very fast, odd electronic music that is, you know, frankly, like formally baffling to me. So I like that emergence and that shattering. And I think that's what makes these attempts to rescue the monoculture through coming together around lists of ranked albums. To me, that's so pathetic, you know, and it's longing for a moment that I think can't be sustained. That doesn't mean I'm against the album or I'm against people loving albums. I absolutely like the album, but I don't like this idea that we're all going to gather around the fire and we're going to listen to all the albums and then we're going to rank them. And then we're going to finally know, you know, which are the five greatest. Like, it's just so, it's really missing the point.
Yeah, I have a friend who was a music director of a college radio station in the 80s, and he was outraged when it came out a couple of years ago that I guess it was Billie Eilish, had never heard of Van Halen. And he was saying, oh, how can you not know this musical history? It's so important. And I'm saying, why should a teenager care?
Yeah.
Why Van Halen, please?
Like, we do have a wonderful experience of being on tour, listening to a cassette of Van Halen, and the Van stereo only had the left channel and not the right, and a lot of the songs from one of those albums are mixed so that it's just drums and David Lee Roth on one channel and it's guitar and bass in the other channel, so you get this very hilarious hard pan mix. Recommended.
It never occurred to me that Van Halen did that. That's such an old school stereo thing.
Yeah, that's like a James Brown thing, or like the beginning of stereo, certain like Beatles songs,
or Esquivel even.
Yeah, I think Scott Walker, too, is hard pan, like a 30th century man. It's all acoustic guitar on the right, and it's all his voice on the left. So mashup creators, take note.
Well, did you ever think that you would go into more of the found music thing? I mean, would you go into Tony Schwartz's catalog if you had the opportunity?
Who's Tony Schwartz?
Oh, he's a guy who did a lot of recordings for Folkways. And he kind of pioneered that sounds of the junkyard, and he might have been the one who recorded the sounds of The Office, in fact.
Wow, really?
Oh, I don't think I never came across that name. But then again, I should say, in terms of this record that we made, we received not records with liner notes, but digital files.
With PDFs of liner notes.
In some cases.
And we had hundreds of them. It was hundreds of hours of music. So we were going on, strangely, a mix of like, well, you have to listen to everything and hear it as sound, but you're also thinking, what's the conceptual handle of the name? You know, if something is like The Sounds of Medicine, then you're like, oh, I'm listening for the medical. But yeah, I'm embarrassed that we didn't recognize Tony Schwartz's name.
If yeah, me neither.
Is in fact the auteur behind the things that were sampled. I mean, we.
But wait, you were saying, I thought your question was, would you ever want to be more musical?
Oh, well, if I said that, I that's not exactly what I meant to say. I was just curious if that's a direction you would want to go into more in the future in terms of, you said you hadn't necessarily sampled things in a plunderphonic sort of way.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, we had done it with the previous album, which was a response to the electroacoustic music of Polish composer Bogusław Schaefer. So we had made a whole album of manipulating the sort of choral and piano and electronic sounds of Bogusław Schaefer, and making kind of new music out of old music. So I think our pendulum kind of swings back and forth, you know. We're working on new music now, and we're going to share some of that at the concert that nobody has to go to, but they can if they're into that. So you may hear some new sounds from what might be the next Matmus album. But I'm honestly still not convinced, you know. I think we have we have to really believe in something.
There's a poster on the wall behind me that says The Metal Album.
I was just going to ask about that.
I don't know if it's going to work or not. I feel like
we take turns being in charge of the albums, quote, to keep from fighting about it.
Well, that doesn't work, obviously.
I think Drew is in charge of the next one, which I thought was the Metal Album.
I thought it was too, but I'm having a crisis of confidence. You know, I think I'm having that Lana Del Rey Summertime Sadness, y'all. It's summertime, and I just don't. Everything's going soft like a banana that you should have eaten like 2 days ago, and now you're looking at it and you're like, I just don't know. So I don't know if it's me or the songs or me needing the songs, but you know, I have been enjoying playing some of this new material that's made all out of metal objects and metal sounds. You know, figuring out what we want to work with. I mean, in some ways, that's been a hallmark of our practice since the at least the second album, making entire songs out of a single sound source. And that becomes kind of a playful encounter with the materiality of a given kind of substance. So making the whole album Plastic Anniversary out of plastic objects, you know, you're exploring the range of like, what can plastic sound like? What can we do with plastic? And then also, what do our manipulation techniques let us do to supplement the ways that a given material does and doesn't want to sound? And it's the same with metal. Like, I think the risk with working with a lot of metal is you got a lot of bright, hard, sharp attack, but you can have a lot of ear fatigue after about 30 minutes if it's all metallic, you know, chimes. I mean, if you think of the beauty of Gamelan, part of that is that you've got these deep, low, resonant gongs that are so long, you know, and that's a contrast to the sharp, you know, tinkling of like the smaller materials.
Oh, I think the noise cancellation removed that sound.
It's kind of silent, doesn't it?
Yeah, does it become nothing? That's amazing.
Yeah, I can't hear anything.
Nothing.
Not anything.
Wow.
I'm bang a gong, get it off.
For those of you at home who can't see the video screen, I'm slamming a thing into a giant metal gong.
It looks like it makes a great sound. I wish I knew what it sounded like.
Well, that's the beauty of conceptual art, is that the sound in your mind as you imagine a sound is more beautiful than any sound in the world. Can you hear that?
I heard about half of that.
Okay.
So if a tree falls in the forest and you are there to hear it, but it doesn't make a sound, is it still a sound, or what's the...
The sound in the mind.
For those listening at home, more instruments are being played that are not being heard, just so you know. Well, gentlemen, I could keep doing this all day, but we have just a limited amount of time, so unfortunately I have to wrap it up. But thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest.
It's been our pleasure.
And those listeners out there, do or don't come and see us. It's your choice.
I'm Jeff Economy, host of Snack Point Charlie, heard the first and third Wednesday of every month from 10 to midnight here on WGXC. I'm here today on WGXC's afternoon show to talk with Rodney Allen Greenblatt, who will be performing as part of the Drive-In Extravaganza on May 31st. That's Negative Land plus Sue C., Matmos, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt at the Greenville Drive-In, May 31st. Tickets available at wgxc.org/drive-in. Welcome, Rodney.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for coming. My pleasure. So tell us about this drive-in show. You're going to be playing at a drive-in?
Yeah, it's very exciting. The Greenville Drive-In is a great place. They have converted an old drive-in into something that's much more culturally present and fun. And I've been to a couple things there. And I haven't been to a concert the size of the one that's going to happen next week, but I'm sure it's going to be great.
And you have a relationship with Matmos, is that correct? Or you just have played with them before? Or
Somewhat. I'm actually a fan. They have inspired my music over the years, and I've been a steady listener to all their albums as they come out. And then about 2 years ago, I went and I saw them play in Montreal. And it was a small club, and they did their show, and it was fun. And I got to talk to them, and I gave them my tape of my last record. I'm not expecting anything of it, but they wrote me back a couple weeks later. They liked my tape. And somehow or other, this guy communicated with WGXC friends, and when they decided to put this show together, they asked me if I wanted to play. So I'm playing for one of my favorite bands. How about that?
That's excellent. I'm curious about how you got into music in the first place. I mean, I've been familiar with your visual work since the 90s, really. I mean, I was, like a lot of people, completely charmed and enchanted and semi-obsessed with Parappa the Rapper and Jammer Lammy. I actually had to give my PlayStation away because I was spending far too much time on the gaming platform. But it came as kind of a surprise to see years later that you were making music. How did that part of your practice evolve?
Well, actually, I've been making music all along. I started learning to play when I was 7 years old on a Hammond organ. And I've always loved electronic music, actually, not knowing that it was a specific thing as a kid. But I would have done anything to get a Moog synthesizer when I was a kid, but it was way too expensive, and I couldn't convince my father to kick over $3,000 in 1974 for a Moog synthesizer, but I can afford one now, thanks to Parappa the Rapper. Over the years, I've made lots of music. Actually, the very first song in Parappa the Rapper, the scene in the movie theater, the opening, mm-hmm. I wrote that music.
Oh, cool.
And played and sang it, actually. And I think Masaya Matsura added some instrumentation and drums and things to it. But basically, I've been doing little bits of, you know. But I've been gigging. I was in a band in art school, a couple of bands. And now, since I moved to Catskill 8 years ago, I found lots of people to support me and play my music in places. The Avalon Lounge has been great. And, I've been at it all these years.
Yeah, tell me more about the Monday morning thing that you do.
Yeah, every Monday morning, I'm in a band called Music for Furniture, and we play improvised electronic music for an hour and a half, starting at 8:30 a.m. People are coming in and having their coffee, and in the background is a orchestra. Sometimes it's usually a quintet of the five of us playing improvised music. David Garland is there, and he actually plays the clarinet and the bass clarinet and the guitar, so it's not all electronic. And then we have his son Kenji on very interesting computer program synthesizers. And then Dan Kirkus, who you may know as Catskill Bread. He's an amazing musician, and he plays a variety of synthesizers and devices. And then Jimmy Garver, he is kind of a laptop genius, and he provides all kinds of sounds. And then I'm on the Moog. We're sometimes all five of us, sometimes less, but every Monday we're back there at Joust Cafe in the middle of Catskill.
I have to confess I've never seen you play, and it's partly because I'm such a night owl. My typical bedtime is around 3 or 4 a.m., so getting up at 8 is a bit of a challenge for me. But
it's a challenge for everyone. It's a crazy time to have a gig, but that was the whole original concept. To have a music gig that was just at a time when no one would expect it. So that's what we do.
Do you find that most people have no idea that you're going to be there when they come in, or do they come just to see you?
Well, we have a bit of a following, some just neighbors and friends, but they all work on their laptops and do their email while we're playing, and we love that, actually. And the coffee is good, and there's food, nice food at Joust, so... yeah, it's a great place to hang out and listen to us go through an adventure, basically. We just go through different phases of music and sounds, and it's pretty interesting.
And you have a project with Jimmy Garver, is that correct? Or I'm sorry, I know that you have one. I can't remember the name offhand, but I have heard the record. But tell us a little bit about that.
Jimmy and I have collaborated on something called Sending.
That's it.
And like I said, he's a genius at bass and drums and sound effects. And I basically add my Moogy sounds on top of that. And we made a record together a couple years ago. It sounded pretty good.
Yeah, I've played some on my show, and I know it's been in rotation on WGXC as well. Mm. I'm curious about your philosophy towards electronic music, towards a synthesizer. How would you summarize your approach? I mean, not that it has to be summarized in a sentence, but give me an idea what where you're coming from, where you're going with it.
Hmm. I've always been fascinated with it, to be able to create your own sounds or edit sounds that are found on the machines. I think in a funny way in my mind, electronic music is very pure. It comes out of a circuit or some kind of device inside of a machine. There's no strings or... sounding board or anything like that, although it gets connected to those kinds of things. It's just this strange, interesting sound. I think when I was a kid, I went at video arcades, and I was wondering where the music was coming from. Was it coming from a recording? And I realized, no, actually the computers are generating those weird little video game music. And that made me really interested in how that was done. And as soon as I could afford to buy a synthesizer, I did. And I started to learn how you make those different timbres and different effects and different kinds of sounds.
It's interesting that you, one of the first things you describe is the clean quality of the sound. And I'm wondering if that in any way ties into your visual practice, because so much of the visual art you do has a kind of 2D quality and a very deliberate one, it seems to me. And I'm curious how those things if you see any relationship between them.
Yeah, I suppose there is. I do like some simplicity, and I always move towards some kind of visual simplicity in a certain way, in a cartoon kind of a way. And I've actually, if you listen to some of my other, my solo music, there is a kind of a cartoonish flatness, I guess you could say, to some of it. And I guess that's just natural for me.
When you say that's natural for you, it's I don't think it's natural for necessarily everyone. So me, and that's, it's not a pro or con. I mean, I'm drawn to that myself, but I'm curious what, how that's natural. I mean, and that might be impossible to explain, and asking someone to get into that, the basis of their art, and maybe that's something you don't want to go into, but I'm curious what, how that's so natural to you.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I've talked about in many interviews, the basis of my art is basically, animations that I watched on TV when I was a kid. I had artistic talent at a very young age, my parents discovered. And they felt that I was an artist. But the art that I was actually looking at that was forming the aesthetic that I love was on TV, like Gumby, for example, that animation series. And also Bullwinkle and all of that interesting animation, very flat, funny, slapstick, interesting stuff. Yeah, I mean, that's where, that's like deep back brain kind of thing. When I look at Gumby now, you can watch episodes on YouTube or something. The forms and the colors are so much like my forms and colors that I've used in my adult life. Everything about it just sort of went back into the storehouse back there and just keeps coming back up, which I think is great.
Well, it's interesting to me as well, because Art Clokey was a notorious proponent of Zen, and there's references to it in the Gumby shorts, you know, Gumby going to the Zen cafe for coffee or whatnot.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that ties into your interest in Zen.
Well, I don't think I caught that when I was a kid watching it. But I have seen in the scene, there's a little town that they drive through, and there's a Zen cafe in the town that they sometimes drive by. Gumby and Pokey drive by in their Model T, I think. But anyway, my interest in Zen was kind of separate from all that in a way. I don't know. It's a long story, but when I was a kid, I found or was given a little keychain with a little Buddha on the keychain, and I wondered what was it about. And I always had an interest in Buddhism since then. Forgot about it for a while, and then, as you know, I worked in Japan when I worked for Sony, and I used to go to the temples as a tourist. But I was still thinking, like, what are these Buddha statues? What is this all really about? There must be some profound meaning. But I didn't know what it was. So then I couldn't get any of my... None of my Japanese friends could explain it to me. So I figured there must be more to it. And I knew that I could find a Zen temple when I went back to New York, where I lived. And I did find a Zen temple right around the corner from where I lived. It was the Village Zendo, and I started there in 2008.
So did you have any prior religious or spiritual upbringing, or did that just come out of the blue, like that Buddha appeared and that was what set you off?
It pretty much came out of the blue. My father's family was Jewish, and my mother's family was, well, my grandmother anyway, was a Catholic. So I got to see both of those things. I guess neither of them made much of an impression. I'm not sure, but I wasn't really necessarily interested as a kid. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, 10 years old or 12 years old or something. But yeah, for some reason, the little Buddha and then the temples and all that stuff appealed to me.
It just occurred to me as you were talking about this, I have a little Parappa, sort of a flat figurine that I got from the Rodney shop when that was open. It's on the dashboard of my car. And I just realized, thinking about it, that the outline, the shape of Parappa is actually pretty similar to the sitting Buddha.
I have not thought of that before, but why not? You know, little, like some kind of a Southeast Asian Buddha with a pointed top or something. That's interesting. Maybe so. Who knows? I mean, I was in Japan. I worked for Sony for 10 years. I didn't live there, but I was going back and forth quite a bit, and I was really into seeing temples and learning about Japanese culture. So, yeah, why not?
So, do you think that, how conspicuously does that present itself in the music? I mean, the things I've heard, there's not any, it's not like, oh, this is religious music and it's very forward, but how conscious is that to you when you're making the music, or is it just part of everything that you do and you don't even think about it?
Yeah. But I think for me, Zen is about the self, letting go of the self, then finding out who you really are, expressing yourself in an honest way. And I think I've somehow been able to do that. It isn't religious or Buddhist in any way, but it's the kind of music that makes me happy. I enjoy making it. I guess I'm not that concerned about other people listening to it. Because if I did, that would be a problem. But I don't. I just love making electronic music. And I think it's just me expressing myself very honestly, I would guess.
So do you still do are you still running the Zen practice for other people? I remember I had a postcard a long time ago that announced that you were doing that, and I wasn't sure if that was still an active practice.
Yeah. In fact, I'm running the Catskill Zen Circle. It's right here on Main Street. You can look it up on the internet, Catskill Zen Circle. And I'm the teacher there, which is a lot of fun. We have a great group. It's easy to do.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about what you have planned, or what people can expect to see when they come to see you at the drive-in show.
Yeah, I know from looking at my Bandcamp and my Apple Music streams that not many people listen to my music, I just decided I'll make new music. What would matter? It isn't like they're coming to hear their favorite songs. So I've made 6 new short pieces, and I'm going to fit them into 20 minutes. And it's going to be fun. I've been rehearsing. My gear is over here, and I'm going to play 6 new songs for you all.
Excellent. I look forward to hearing them. Can you tell our listeners what your websites are so they can find your music?
Oh, yeah. For my music, go on Bandcamp / Rodney Allen Greenblatt. That's easy enough. And then my website that I've had for years and years is called whimsyload.com, like whimsy load, LOAD. And I've had that website for, I don't know, almost maybe 30 years I've had that URL, and I've had that website. So it has a lot of my artwork and some stuff about Parappa and my other projects and links to other things.
So is there any chance that we'll see a return of the Rodney Shop in any form? Will there be a one-time pop-up even at some point?
Probably not. I realize the retail business is incredibly difficult. And I sold most of the stuff that I had collected. So that was kind of a goal. I made lots of friends. I mean, it was really fun, but I don't think I'm going to put it back in the brick and mortar form. Now, I sell on my website some of my stuff and some Parappa stuff. I'm still getting samples from Japan, so once in a while I put them up there.
All right. Well, there's a lot of opportunities for people to enter the world of Rodney Allen Greenblatt, which is who we've been talking to and who you'll be able to see Friday, May 31st at the Greenville Drive-In in Greenville, New York, along with Negative Land and Matmos. I should say Negative Land plus Sue C., their visual collaborator.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Rodney, for talking with us. And we'll see you then.
Thanks so much. And see you at the show.
Hits when she's eating a tea. To me it sounds like Batsy B.